And thus, this truth becomes concealed. And these veils that he constructed exist on many levels, on many gradations and many ranks. As the Alter Rebbe put it in the beginning of this chapter, there are different types of tzimtzumim, different types of contractions, constrictions, limitations, veils, masks, and disguises that Hashem constructs in order to disguise His intimate reality as well as His Word, His creative energy. And as a result of that, so many different types of worlds and different creatures are created. Which means, in other words, that the recipients of Hashem's creative energy, which are all the worlds, all the universes, all their existences, the angels and the souls and the highest and the lowest universes and all objects in it, do not receive the creative energy directly. Hashem veils this creative energy. So they receive it via various veils and via various contractions and limitations and constrictions and disguises. A very powerful, nuanced, complex process of tzimtzum. And as a result of that, they, the recipients, do not appreciate the true nature of reality. They redefine reality in new terms. And this exists on many levels. At the end of chapter 21, the Alter Rebbe said that there is that level of tzimtzum, of contractions, that weakens the intensity of the creative energy of the Word. And as a result of that, the recipients of the energy feel and sense that the Word left the speaker. If the Word left the speaker, it has an identity. If the Word has an identity, the cosmos it creates has an identity. If there would be no contraction, no limitation, it would be obvious to the created beings that the Word never left its speaker, and thus they would never assume an identity. They would be in touch with the true rhythm of life, namely that they are nothing. The only reality is Gashem Echad. But the concealment, they are created via creative energy that conceals itself. And that concealment impacts it. So they sense that the Word left the speaker. They don't feel the truth that the Word is still absorbed in the speaker. There's a dichotomy created. Hashem allows them to perceive that there is a partition. There's a dichotomy between the speech and the speaker. They do not feel the speaker in the space of the speech. So they have an identity. There's a level of self-consciousness. And this is true even about the highest worlds, which are defined as worlds. Olam, we spoke last week, that the etymology, the Alter Rebbe explains in Likutei Torah and Shlach, that the etymology of the word Olam is concealment. Olam means concealment, because even the highest world cannot tolerate total exposure. If there would be total exposure of truth, if the naked truth would be exposed, the world would be reduced to nothingness. Not that it wouldn't exist. It would exist, but its existence would not have an identity. It wouldn't define its existence as a reality. Reality is Hashem's intimacy. So the tzimtzum allows them to perceive the speech as having left the speaker, and thus they assume a status. That was the end of 21. In 22, the Alter Rebbe added that there are even deeper and more intense contractions that occur to the Hashem's words, which as a result of these contractions and veils and concealments and garments and disguises and so forth, Hashem's speech creates not only things that don't sense the speech as it is still absorbed in the speaker, they sense the speech as having left the speaker, but furthermore, it creates such types of realities that experience themselves as distinct from the speech. The higher worlds have an identity, but how do they define their identity? They define their identity exclusively in terms of divinity. They define themselves as expressions of divine energy, as expressions of the stroke of the pen of the author of existence. That's why they're totally spiritual, they're totally godly. They know they don't have a reality outside of the Word. They feel that the word left the speaker, and therefore they assume a status. Some are the expressions of divine energy, but expressions of divine energy. In chapter 22, he adds that the contraction sometimes becomes so powerful that the word creates something that assumes an ego of its own. It might know that it came from Hashem's word, but after it came from Hashem's word, it has its own identity, it has its own ego. And this is where the reality of klipa emerges. The reality of klipa and sitracha, which is the term employed in Kabbalah and Chassidus for unholiness, for ungodliness. How does this come into existence? This comes into existence because of such powerful concealments imposed by Hashem on His creative energy that He creates things that have an ego of their own, even though at that very moment they're being brought into being something from nothing, and they're being brought into being by Hashem's word, which is absorbed within them. But it's totally not sensed within their consciousness and within their identity. And they perceive themselves as being valuable in terms of their own, of a self-oriented existence detached from the divine energy. So the tzimtzum, the divine contractions, the tzimtzumim, operate on many, many levels. There are myriads of categories in these contractions. The Alter Rebbe explains elsewhere, he gives the analogy of a person who hangs a thick curtain on a window to screen out the sunlight. So the light that enters the room through the curtain will be of another quality. You can even describe it as an echo of the original light. And what happens if you place a second curtain, and then a third, and a fourth, and so forth? And what if one curtain is denser than the previous one? So the final product will share almost no resemblance to the original light. So the stronger the tzimtzum, the stronger the curtain, the stronger the concealment, the stronger the hester upon him, the concealment of Hashem's countenance, the more powerful the sense of separateness and disconnection from Hashem. The greater the concealment, the more profound the egotistical perception of the created being. The less dense the concealment, the more the sense of godliness. The less dense the curtain, the mask, the less the sense of I. The more dense, the greater the sense of I. As the tzimtzumim become more powerful, the creatures that are created by Hashem's word that go through these powerful tzimtzumim have a bigger ego. If there is more concealment, the ego becomes more pompous. If it's yet a deeper concealment, the ego becomes even deeper and more powerful and more all-pervading. Till the extent that the tzimtzum can be so profound that Hashem's word can produce and sustain and create and invigorate an identity or reality which can outrightly deny the fact that there's a speaker and that there's a speech. He can say the speaker is dead and he never gave a speech and he never existed and so forth. And Alter Rebbe here in Tanya doesn't get into this lowest level, this third level explicitly, although he indicates it. But this is a very powerful level of concealment where the reality that's being created by the word that's absorbed in the speaker totally is not unaware of it and can deny it at that very moment when it's being sustained by the divine energy. So there is that level of existence, there is that perception of existence where I experience the speech and I'm totally in touch with the fact that I am totally dependent upon the speech. But yet I have an identity because the speech has an identity because in my experience the speech left the speaker. It's separated from the speaker. It's not submerged, it's not nullified. And we're talking about the emotional level of awareness of these realities. They might read somewhere that the speech never left the speaker, but in their emotional, experiential life, they feel that the speech left the speaker. They're not in touch emotionally with the presence of Hashem's intimacy, and therefore, they assume significance, they assume eminence, they attribute validity to their identity as embodiments of the divine creative energy. That's one level that's discussed at the end of chapter 21. We learned that week. In chapter 22, now he adds deep, lower levels. There you perceive the speech, you perceive your dependence upon the speech. Then there is where you perceive the speech, but you don't perceive that you're dependent upon the speech. The speech becomes so veiled that it invigorates a reality that perceives itself as detached from the speech. It was created by it, but it has its own ego, even though in essence it doesn't have its own ego. Its entire identity is the fact that it expresses, that it's an expression of the divine energy. But that's how it perceives itself. And then there can be an even a lower level. It doesn't even acknowledge the existence of a speech altogether. And in each one, there are numerous and myriads of levels that create all the different types of perceptions and all different types of levels of self-consciousness. But the common denominator is any level of self-consciousness is coming from a mask. Because there was a mask, so I feel myself. I have an ego. And this is what the Alter Rebbe is teaching us in chapter 22. The reality of self-consciousness on all levels until the powerful self-consciousness existing in Klipa, Tuma, Sitra Achra, unholiness and ungodliness, which means all realities that experience themselves as detached and as distinct from Hashem, they don't define themselves as godly, they don't define themselves as part of holiness, as subservient to holiness, is comes only and exclusively as a consequence of the fact that truth is being covered. And that's the only way in which these realities, these behavioral patterns, these experiences, these identities can exist. You know, we know in history that the first thing that all professional dictators did in order to secure their throne was they immediately sealed off the channels of information to the masses. They knew that if the truth of what's going on in the government and the leadership is exposed, that's the end of their power. Because the corruption, the evil is exposed. So the first thing a real dictator has to do is he has to make sure that he screens all the information that's coming out to the masses. His existence depends upon a cover-up. Whenever there's corruption in an institution, in a company, in an organization, real corruption, the people that are behind this corruption, in order for them to exist as leaders in this company, they have to make sure that truth is covered. If the truth leaks out of this total exposure, of this total openness, that's the end of them. When you're legal, you don't mind if your books are open. You don't mind. But if you're illegal for you to survive, your books have to be closed. They have to be covered. There has to be a mask. Certain realities cannot exist, cannot tolerate exposure. If the truth is open, that's the end of their existence because their nothingness, their falsehood, their zeroness comes glaring at you. So the greatest danger, the Alter Rebbe says, for Klipa, you know what the greatest danger for unholiness is? Exposure. That reveals that it's really nothing. It's not a coincidence that the term used constantly in Kabbalah and Chassidus and the whole Tanya in this chapter to describe unholiness and ungodliness as klipa. What is klipa? A shell, a husk, a mask. Why? Because its entire reality constitutes a cover-up. A few weeks we'll celebrate Purim. What's the episode that commences the Megillus Esther, the scroll of Esther, which we will read on Purim? Vayehi b'mei Achashverosh, it was in the times of Achashverosh, the mighty emperor of Persia. He throws a major party in his capital city in Shushan. And on the seventh day of the feast, Kitoiv Lev HaMelech Bayoyin, when the heart of the king is merry with wine, he orders seven of his chamberlains to call in, to bring in his queen Vashti before him so that she show off her beauty. And the Megillah tells us that Vashti refuses to appear and the king is outraged and ultimately he has her killed. What's the meaning behind the story so that everybody knows the Gemara? The Gemara explains in Masechet Megillah in on Daf Yud Beis Amud Beis. So the Gemara that when Ahasuerus offered his guest to show them his wife's beauty, they insisted that she appear without any garments. But as the Gemara relates, she broke out in a leprosy. Or another opinion is that the angel Gavriel, Malach Gavriel, Gabriel, came and made her grow a tail. So under such circumstances, she obviously would not appear without any garments. And that's why she refused to show up. So I never understood, if that was the case, why did he kill her? She could have easily sent a message to her husband to explain to him that he himself would never want her to appear under such circumstances. Obviously, it would be uncomfortable for her to relate the truth about what was going on to her body at that moment to her husband. But nonetheless, she could have easily spared her life. Why didn't she tell him, Ahasuerus, I spared you awesome humiliation by refusing to show up? He was talking intoxicated, but intoxicated to the extent of executing his own queen for sparing him tremendous embarrassment. And why is this story the opening of the Megillah? It occupies the entire first chapter of Megillah's Esther. It does serve as a prelude to the continuation of the story, because as a result of this, Queen Esther was chosen as the wife of Ahasuerus. But nonetheless, the detailed description of the event that brought about Vashti's execution seems somewhat superfluous as the whole opening chapter of Megillah Esther. So the Baal Shem Tov once explained this story from a spiritual point of view. An explanation of the Baal Shem Tov is quoted in a sefer called Eir HaMeir by Reb Ze'ev Wolf of Zhitomir, who was a pupil, a chassid of the Maggid of Mizrich. And according to the Baal Shem Tov, this episode encapsulates one of the deepest truths of life. And it's the message of the 22nd chapter of Tanya, Chav Beis. What's the key feature, according to Chassidus and Tanya? What would you define the key feature that distinguishes holiness from unholiness? Holiness thrives on openness and honesty. Unholiness, negativity, thrives on cover-ups and masks. Let's take an example, a personal example in our lives. Suppose you're overtaken by a powerful, unhealthy, and immoral temptation. And you're about to act on that urge. Think a moment about some of those instincts, cravings, urges that sometimes take you over that are very powerful, and you know they're unhealthy, they're immoral, they're improper from a physical, psychological, emotional, spiritual perspective. But nonetheless, you succumb, you surrender, and you're ready to act upon it. And at that moment, one of your closest friends gives you a call. And he says, brother, tell me about your soul. Share with me what matters most to you in your life. What are your deepest passions? What are your deepest convictions? What do you live for? What are your real ideals? If you want to continue acting out on that urge, you have no choice but to hang up that phone and to hang it up fast. You can't engage right now in a conversation about what matters to you most in your soul if you want to continue acting on that urge. You have to ignore his words. In the midst of acting on a temptation of that nature, you can't afford to meditate on your inner soul, on your quintessential as self. Temptations, addictions, promiscuous behavior, if they are to survive, to thrive, they're in desperate need of facades. They cannot tolerate real questions to be asked. They can't welcome real exposure. That would be self-defeating. They flourish on spontaneity, on lack of meditation, on a void of real contemplation and consideration. When I don't think, I shut off my mind, I shut off my inner heart, my true passions, then I can sin. On the other hand, when you're engaging in a healthy act, in a moral deed, when you're engaged in doing a mitzvah, for example. And somebody calls you, your friend calls you and says, tell me, what are your deepest passions? What matters most to you in your life? You're comfortable at that moment to deal with the most intimate questions. Because a human being is naturally and essentially holy, spiritual, godly. So when my behavior is consistent with my real essence, I don't fear being emotionally exposed. For sin to thrive in my life, I need to cover up my true self. Because my true self is holy, my true self is spiritual, my true self is godly. So how can I sin? So I have to suppress my true self. I cover it up, I suppress it, I ignore it, and now I can sin. Now I can feel that I want to sin, that I enjoy sin, that this is who I am. And that's what klipa is all about. Klipa means a mask. It masks up my soul. It assumes, it gives me the impression that I have a personality, that I have a self which I really don't have. A self that's gross, a self that's coarse, a self that's materialistic, a self that's debased. And now I can sin. So when you call me up and you say, hey, tell me about your truth, it can't work together. But when I'm in the middle of a mitzvah, so now I can deal with the most intimate questions. So klipa cannot tolerate real questions. It can never tolerate real exposure. Total raw exposure would defeat it absolutely. So when the King of Kings, Achashverosh, is always the metaphor in Chassidus and in Kabbalah for the King of Kings, the Rama writes in Mechir Yayin, his commentary on Megillas Esther, Achashverosh, is Acharis Vereshis Shaloi. It's an acronym of the entity, the being. That the end and the beginning belong to him. The end and the beginning are his. When the cosmic King of Kings, Hashem, calls on Vashti. Vashti personifying the epitome of unholiness. And Vashti is confronted and challenged by the King of Kings to appear at the feast, at the cosmic feast, without any garments. He is requesting something that could never happen. Because if Vashti is to become exposed, she ceases to be. Vashti can only exist in the presence of coverings, of masks, of veils, of ambiguity, of disguises. So the natural consequence of it is that Vashti loses her life. When she's called on her truth, when you ask her, show me truth, remove all the masks, the consequence is that Vashti becomes nothing. Vashti can't appear. It's an oxymoron. If you want Vashti, she has to be with clothes. Real honesty. Rawness only in holiness. Klipa can't tolerate it. So here we had a Jew who tragically substituted his real identity for a masqueraded one. He lived with masks. He lived a lie that was alienated from he lived a life in which he alienated himself and his behavior from his true inner self. So he comes to the Tzemach Tzedek, and the Tzemach Tzedek, for whatever reason, sends him to the Holy Ruzhiner. The mirror situated in the chamber of the Ruzhiner was a special mirror. It was a mirror of truth. It was a mirror that couldn't tolerate facades. So when the Jew gazes into the Rebbe's mirror, he gazes, maybe for a fleeting moment, but for that moment he gazes upon his own truth. He sees who he is. For a brief moment, all the facades were gone. His own truth emerged, so he naturally fainted. And this is the challenge of life. The challenge of life is that we are to make sure that what we do at every moment is never an outgrowth of a lie. It's never a consequence of a cover-up. It's an expression of our real self. At any stage of our life, we are not to fear exposure. Exposure to ourselves, I'm talking about. If you're living like that, you're living a healthy life. You're living a real life. If you're engaged in anything, and during that act, you fear exposure, that means that act is a betrayal against your own reality. It's a betrayal against your truth, and that's why you have to cover up. And that's what klipa means. That's the difference of kedusha and klipa. There's a frequent expression in Hasidic discourses, in the Alter Rebbe's books, and in other books in Chabad Chassidus, and in general, in the general literature of Chassidus, that goodness, toiv, is a mitzius amitis, is a true reality. And ra, evil, is an untrue reality. What does that mean? So here in Tanya we have an explanation. You see, some people make a powerful error. They interpret these statements in Chassidus to mean that good is true, and evil is an illusion, it doesn't really exist, it only exists in your imagination, it's a hallucination, it's a dream. That's wrong. Evil exists and evil has a power, and unfortunately we witness how evil destroys lives. And this we have seen in our generation. Our generation has witnessed the power of evil in dimensions that no one would believe, that were unfathomable, that were unimaginable. What does Chassidus mean? So here in Tanya we have the crystal clear explanation for it. Evil exists. Unfortunately, it has a power. But its entire power comes from truth being covered up. It doesn't have an intrinsic power. It doesn't have a truth behind it. It doesn't have a foundation of truth. Its entire existence, intensity, power, and strength comes from the fact that truth is being covered. And the moment that the covering is removed, it's nullified, because its only existence begins when truth is covered up. And thus, ultimately, the bubble will burst, because its entire existence is based on a lie. It doesn't have an intrinsic existence. There's nothing real about it. Although it exists in reality, but there's nothing real about it. Its entire power comes from the fact that truth is being covered, that truth is being suppressed, that it's being ignored. So ultimately, one day it's going to bust and it will become nothing. Because when truth is revealed, which means when reality is revealed and reality ultimately gets exposed, because that's real, that's the real story. So it ultimately is reduced to nothingness. Goodness has an intrinsic power. It's real. It can face the deepest exposure and it will exist because it's inherent, it's intrinsic, it's God. So now this is how the Alter Rebbe began the chapter 22. How did he begin? In chapter 21 he said that what? That there is a concealment that exists in the creation process. And this concealment allows the created realities to perceive themselves as having an identity. They have a self-consciousness. Why they have a self-consciousness? Because in their emotional and experiential psyche, the speech that invigorates them left the speaker. But it does not obscure, but these concealments only work one way. Because it does not obscure Hashem's vision, it only obscures our vision. Because since these contractions were constructed by Hashem, the veils are godly. And godliness can't conceal godliness. So the veils only block our vision, but don't block Hashem's vision. So for Hashem, reality still remains the same. Kula kamei kelei chashev, everything in His presence, from His point of view, is as though it doesn't exist. He's the only reality. From the true perspective, the tzimtzumim, these concealments and limitations, only work one way. We discussed last week the example that's brought in Chassidus, somebody who communicates a message to his audience through a riddle. For them, the riddle is a veil, it's a mystery, it's a confusing maze. It doesn't allow them to behold the message that's contained therein. That's what a riddle is. It conceals. But for the communicator himself, he knows the answer to the riddle. So the riddle does not constitute a mask at all. It's not a mask. They tell the story of a father who was very enlightened. So he didn't want his child to believe in Hashem. His child was a natural believer in Hashem, like children believe naturally. He wanted to eradicate the faith from his child. So one night, as his child was sleeping, father walks over to his bed. He writes a message on a note. And the message reads, God is nowhere. And he puts it under his child's bed, his child's pillow. In the morning, the child awakes. He runs to his father. And he says, Tati, I received a message last night. I read under my pillow a note. And it reads, God is now here. The father writes, God is nowhere. And he reads, God is now here. So the very same letters can serve as an obscuring force against Hashem or as an affirmation of Hashem's oneness. So since the tzimtzum, the concealment, the veil, is a godly veil, it doesn't conceal Hashem's perspective. Just as we spoke last week, if I cover my head with my palm, it's not considered a cover in halacha. Because my hand is part of my head. Because it's part of one body. So from Hashem's point of view, there's no tzimtzum. The tzimtzum is totally transparent. So there's only He. There's He and there's nothing else besides He. But in chapter 22, the Alter Rebbe adds something. That the Torah calls Hashem's creative energy a speech. And a Torah dibra kelosha b'nei adam. Torah employs human language. Torah employs human language is a statement that our sages make in Gemara more than a dozen times in Shas. And literally what the Gemara is saying is, for example, in Masechta Brachos, Daf Lamed Aleph Amud Beis, the Gemara quotes the Pasuk in the beginning of Shmuel in the prayer of Chana. She repeats herself. She repeats a word twice. She says, Imra'ay Tira, if seeing you will see. Zog the Gemara that the repetition doesn't indicate anything special. Dibra Torah Kalashim B'nei Adam, the Torah spoke according to the language of men, and commonly human beings repeat phrases. So the Torah also repeats phrases. So the Torah is Imra Yitir. But apparently the Alter Rebbe is interpreting this statement deeper. What the Alter Rebbe is seeing in this statement is that the meaning behind the vocabulary of men applies to Torah as well. Not just Torah speaks, employs the language of men. The vocabulary, the meaning that human beings have when they say a word, that applies to the meaning of Torah as well. Torah means that. So when Torah says that Hashem's creation is called Hashem speaking, in human terms, speaking denotes separation. The definition of a speech doesn't only mean actualization, like the Alter Rebbe said in chapter 21. Chapter 21, he said, why is Hashem's speech called a speech? Because speech means actualization, revelation. And in creation, Hashem actualizes His creative power. But here the Alter Rebbe says, in the human condition, speech also denotes separation. Speech means I communicate something to somebody outside of me. So we must conclude that since the Torah employs the term speech, and the Torah all includes the meaning that's employed by human beings, and by human beings, speech means separation. So when Hashem speaks, it becomes separated from Him. But in chapter 21, he explained it doesn't become separated from Him. So the Alter Rebbe says, L'fisha be'emes kachu, because the truth is that it becomes separated from Him. But not from Hashem's perspective, only from our perspective. Ultimate truth is that it's not separated from Him. Because for Hashem, all the veils are meaningless. They're irrelevant. They're transparent. It's as though they don't exist. But from our point of view, the veils are veils. And the veils really conceal the speaker. And the veils really conceal the speech. So we experience the world as something separated from Hashem. So in the world of Klipa, it's really Klipa. It's really impure. From Hashem's perspective, there's no concealments. And the speech is invigorating everything at every moment. And the speech is absorbed in the speaker. And the only reality is God is one. That's true. But from our perspective, we can really define this as klipa, as evil, as negativity, as something that's combating the truth of godliness. Why? Because for us, the tzimtzumim are a reality. They have a truth to them in our world. From our perspective, like as Hashem created us, the tzimtzumim are true. And thus the separation has a truth to it. And therefore we define something as klipa, as impure, as unholy. That's why there's a concept of saying that something is forbidden. What do you mean this thing is forbidden? This thing is forbidden. Is there a thing? Hashem is one. There is He and there's none else besides He. But what's the answer? This is what Alter Rebbe is telling us. True. If there was no tzimtzum, there would be no separation, and there would be no klipa, and there would be nothing forbidden. It would be revealed that there's nothing detached from Him. Everything would shout and cry, Einoid Milvadai! There is He and there's none else besides He. The entire existence, personality, perspective of klipa comes from the fact that reality is concealed. But in our world and in the world of klipa, this concealment is true. So the true definition of this thing is that it's forbidden, that it's ungodly, that it's unholy, that it constitutes a lie, that it constitutes a betrayal of godliness. And it's interesting, I saw in one of the commentaries on Tanya, in the Bi'ur Tanya, the Sefer Bi'ur Tanya, he says that this is a depth that the Alter Rebbe also finds in the statement of our sages, Dibra Torah Kalasha B'nai Adam. The Torah employs human language. It doesn't only mean that the meaning behind human vocabulary applies to the Torah as well. It also explains how. Even though the truth is that Hashem's speech is not separated from Him, but the Torah speaks in human language. And since in the world of human beings, the speech is perceived as being separated from Him, so that's why the Torah also applies the term speech to Hashem, because Torah acknowledges the truth, how it's experienced from the world's perspective, even though from Hashem's perspective, it's not the case. And hence we have the phenomenon of klipa. What's klipa? A reality, a thought, an act, a craving, a force, a deed, a word that is basically a perpetuation of the perception that there is something detached from godliness. Klipa is any act or any craving that defines us as unholy, as ungodly, as not totally submerged in the reality of Hashem Echad. That's what klipa is. Any act that perpetuates that lie, that betrayal of reality is klipa. This thought, this act, this craving is sustained at this moment and created at this moment and invigorated this moment by Hashem's creative energy, by Hashem's word. In fact, it has no reality outside of the divine word. What is more, the word which creates the klipa, the mask, which creates the product as a result of the mask, the word is masked by a klipa, by a shell, by a husk, by a veil. And as a result of that, it creates realities that we call klipa. This word which creates the klipa is absorbed in its essence. It's absorbed in its source, which means that the only true existing reality is Hashem Himself, as explained before. What is going on here? It's behaving as though it's totally detached from Hashem. It may behave as though there's no God at all. And on the other hand, at this very moment is He and there's none else besides He. And this is a result of the cosmic tzimtzum, of the cosmic veil. The divine invigorating power becomes so muted that it allows for its offspring to entertain a perception of autonomy and detachment. It allows it to fake its way through life as though there was anything but Hashem Himself. It allows it to live the lie, to perpetuate the lie that there's something outside of the all-pervading sanctity and splendor of Hashem.
The Gemara says in Gittin, Daf Nun Vav Amud Beis, the Gemara describes the horrible things that Titus, the general, the Roman general Titus, did to the second Beis HaMikdash. He went into the Holy of Holies. When the Roman legions destroyed the Beis HaMikdash approximately in the year 70 after the Common Era. So the Gemara attributes to that experience the Pasuk Micha Moicha Be'elim Hashem, which literally means who is like you among the mighty ones Hashem. So the Gemara Micha Moicha Be'ilmim Hashem, who is like you among the mute ones Hashem. There's nobody who can be as mute as Hashem. This is a profound doctrine in Kabbalah and Chassidus. We're not going to exhaust it here. I'll just mention that Alter Rebbe elaborates on this theme more in the fourth section of Tanya in Egeres HaKodesh in chapter 25. He defends there a section of Tzavas HaRivash, a book with the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov, that deals with this doctrine and demonstrates in a very powerful section in Tanya, chapter 25 of Egeres HaKodesh, how this one of the most fundamental doctrines in the Arizal's Kabbalah and Luriana Kabbalah, that the Divine Presence ultimately exists in everything, although sometimes it's totally muted and not expressed. And as Alter Rebbe discusses here, we learned before in the last piece we learned today, the nature of this mutedness, so to speak, in Klipa, in two ways. Klipa receives its energy from the holiness, what he calls from the Makif, in a fashion called Makif. Which means it can take energy from holiness without being forced to really change its identity because of it. The classical example brought in Chassidus for this is, the Gemara describes in Brachas a very interesting psychological syndrome. It's called Ganva. The Gemara says, Ganva pumachtar te rachmana karya. The thief, when he is about to perform his act of thievery, calls on Hashem for help. Now imagine, he's stealing, he breaks into a house, and he's about to steal. And he says, God, Master of the Universe, please help me. Does he believe in Hashem or he doesn't believe in Hashem? He believes in Hashem. He asks Hashem to help him. Why doesn't he call on the President of the United States to help him or the Queen of England to help him? No, he believes in Hashem. But if you believe in Hashem, why are you stealing? Hashem told you not to steal. So what's pshat? This is called, he's taking an energy from Makif. Taking an energy from Makif means you can use it and it doesn't change you for real. The thief is using God but not allowing God to really affect his life. Hashem remains detached. They have a relationship. It's called a makivdika relationship, like I explained before. It's an encompassing, more superficial, more transcendental relationship. You can receive nurture from it. You can even receive inspiration from it. You can receive hope from it. The thief says, God, please help me. But you refuse to allow it to change your life. It doesn't become part of you. So Klipa, that's one level. Klipa takes nurture from holiness. Hashem allows himself to communicate energy to the Klipa and invigorate it in a makivdika way. Hashem allows his energy, so to speak, to be manipulated and used, and it remains detached. That's one level. And then another level of muteness is even that level of energy which is internalized in the Klipa is totally subdued. It's in exile. The speech becomes speechless in the presence of the Klipa. And that's why she can behave in total opposition to her true essence, which is an exiled in her, imprisoned. An alien prisoner that's totally subdued. And that's why Sitra Achra and Klipa is defined as a space of death, as the Alter Rebbe put it. What do you mean a space of death? He said, Les Hasar Ponimine, there's no space devoid of him. But since in their own reality, in their own perception, godliness is totally subdued within them and non-felt, it's a space of death. It's a space which is antithetical to life, which by definition, life is godliness. And as the Alter Rebbe pointed out, that the purpose why Hashem created these concealments and these veils that allows the existence of Klipa, which ultimately allows for evil to be practiced and performed in this world. Hashem doesn't create the evil, but He creates certainly the possibility for it. He conceals His all-pervading presence. He conceals the truth of existence. He allows a human being to define himself, his life, in terms of negativity, in terms of self-centeredness, in terms of immorality, in terms of crassness and grossness. It's all because of the concealment that Hashem made, which allows human beings now to take it a step further. The real purpose is for man to reveal the truth of existence. And for man to reveal the truth of existence, for there to you be human beings who will reveal this truth, there was a need for a concealment. And the Alter Rebbe will discuss this concept more at length of the ultimate purpose of this whole process in chapter 36. But here what he points out briefly is Hashem wanted human beings. He wanted human beings to have freedom of choice. He wants that human beings' life should be meaningful, and they should achieve something truly. They should achieve it. A human being who makes decisions and creates values, who struggles to find the truth of life, and thus he created this concealment. So this is the ultimate drama of existence. From the Alter Rebbe's point of view, Hu Levadei Hu, he is one alone. All is he. But to us, it does not seem that way. Quite on the contrary. And man was charged with the mission to pierce through all the veils and to reveal this truth that Hu Levadei Hu, God is one. Man's mission is to confront the lie head on, to confront the veil, and to transform every moment of his life. Every breath of his soul, every utterance of his lips, and every movement of his arms and legs, allowing them all to sing the ultimate and eternal melody that he, all is he, Hu Levadeyu, Hashem Echad, Hashem is one. It's interesting. The Alter Rebbe once attended a bris. I think it was one of his grandchildren, the year Tovkuf Samach Vav, which is 1806. It was Kislev, it might have been 1805. And during the bris, the Alter Rebbe said a maimer, he said a very profound and long Hasidic discourse, and he explained that this is the spiritual meaning behind Mila, behind circumcision. Because just like Hashem's creative energy is dressed in a powerful veil that doesn't allow the world to perceive its God, its own truth, its own godliness, so the human being's creative organ is also veiled by a powerful foreskin, by an arla, by a tzimtzum. And the first mission of man in life is to pierce through the veil, to remove the arla, to remove the foreskin, to remove the concealment, which allows the child to experience the godliness in his soul. And if he can do it in his own soul, he can do it in the world. To remove the tzimtzum and to reveal the truth that he alone is he. So in summation, the bottom line is that Alter Rebbe is saying that if the veils were removed even for a moment, everything would appear as is, nothing outside and separate of Hashem. And this is the reason, as the Alter Rebbe will explain in the continuation of the chapter, which we'll learn next week, for the fact that the Gemara compares and equates arrogance to idolatry. Because arrogance is idolatry. Why? Because now we understand the inflated sense of self, which is arrogance, is in essence a betrayal against Hashem's unity. If you're in touch with Hashem's unity, how can you take your ego too seriously? If I take my ego so seriously, it means I don't get it. Have a good day and a wonderful week. How can you identify death with Klipa? The original creation of the world, death wasn't part of the plan. It came as a result of Eitz Hadas.
Rabbi Jacobson delivers this weekly class on the Tanya at Heichal Menachem in the Borough Park section of Brooklyn, New York. To order additional tapes or albums, please call Heichel Menachem at 718-633-1076.